Bread. How's my level, fuckhead?
Look at it.
Look at it.
It looks very good.
It looks very good. Hello, and welcome to another episode of Sounds from the 70s with Gary and Rob. Sometimes referred to as a white Ike Turner.
White Ike Turner, smack! Sorry.
That was not nice. smack! Coming to you for the... smack!
Well, Ike Turner used to be known for his music. And then that changed at some point. That's all I'm saying.
He's really a musical giant, and then you resort to that. That's a low blow.
Michael Jackson.
We are coming to you for the very last time in a shack out in the woods near Old Man Hudson's place. Now, next week's episode, Rob.
Me.
Oh, no. We will be in our brand new studio located not in the metropolis area of the city, but a small drive out of the city. Just to make it an inconvenience for me. Everybody's happy about it.
Yeah.
Except me.
It's moving for tax purposes. But I don't see the savings.
No, I don't. Not the savings for us.
No, I think we're getting screwed.
Now, the man who owns the shack said we had to be out of here for good by the end of tomorrow. Or else he was going to make Rob squeal like a pig.
Squealing like a pig.
And I told him, and I looked right in his face, Rob, and I said, I would like to see you try to make him squeal like a pig. You just try. So we'll see how that... I guess I said the wrong thing because I was trying to combat him with words, and I guess I dared him to do it.
Some people are easy to goad on.
Yeah, very easy. Yeah. It was like, just like, oh yeah, I'll do it. You'll see it. I'll say, well, I won't see it because I don't want to see something like that. But
he'll tell me.
He'll tell me how it happens. Went. Yeah. Sorry about that, Rob. I thought I was making points for us, but I was actually making it worse.
I made him agree not to do it at work. No squealing at work. Bad for morale.
Bad for morale. So, on today's episode, we celebrate the life and legacy of a true music legend, the Queen of Rock, Tina Turner, who passed away recently, and we will be reviewing her 1975 solo album, Acid Queen, which, when Rob was in his experimental days, was called many times
Acid Queen.
For both reasons. For his drug experimentation and for other experimentations.
It was better than when they were calling it the acid ballerina.
Now, our listeners should know, this is a very important thing that I'm bringing up, Rob.
Okay.
Our listeners should know that our band was supposed to practice this week, but Uptown Mike, who people may know as former producer of this show, who did about as bad a job at producing that one person could possibly do.
You could imagine a person doing badly, but you'd be wrong. It'd be worse.
It's worse than the average citizen.
Yeah. It was like he was almost working against us. Almost.
It was almost like he didn't want to be here, which is funny.
But that would describe a level of competence that he doesn't have. So
a good person, but not a good producer.
No.
Well, Mike did not show up again for practice because he is an unreliable prick.
He is. Now, I'm learning. Yeah. I'm learning that better than anyone.
We have no other excuse to give. We can say nicely, but that's not right. We have to say that he is an unreliable prick.
There's no getting around that.
Sometimes we don't find out till 1 hour before.
Sometimes we find out after. Now, even all the lead singers I've worked with at least let you know 5 minutes before the show if something was amiss.
And Mike's always cheery about it. He's like, oh, well, I'm here in another city and I forgot to let you know about practice. But you guys rock on. Well, that was, you know, how could we rock on when it was 2 hours past practice?
Kind of waiting for word there.
Thank you.
Like,
thank you, Mike.
Like fools. Again.
Again. Oh, I like that.
Again. Yeah.
Also, just wanted to point out that after our last episode, I did some calculations, and we should be taping our 200th episode right around the time we do our last show of the year, just before Christmas. So that should air in January or early February of 2024. Right, Rob?
No, I don't remember what year it is.
Also, I do my best. Also, Rob has promised to be very drunk during that episode. Didn't you, Rob? You're going to be drunk during our 200th episode.
That's a drinking episode, and you can't get mad at me for it.
I will not be, as I can't drink, because drinking makes my body feel like it's really bad.
Like he's been punched a bunch of times.
It's kind of like how the professor couldn't drink on Gilligan's Island because he was allergic to alcohol.
Remember that?
And Mr. Howe would call him an egghead. For that reason. Now, that's the kind of sympathy you got back in the 60s when you related a problem to a fellow man, and it was like, oh, you fucking egghead.
And it, of course, gets worse the more drunk Mr. Howell gets.
Well, you know what? You know what? You know what the professor should have done? The professor should have done, well, I may be an egghead, but Mrs. Howell doesn't think so. That would have got him. See, they didn't have that kind of humor.
No,
back then.
I think within a few weeks they'd be down to like 6 castaways.
Mrs. Howell thinks my egghead is very fine.
Three gals, 4 guys. Someone's got to go.
Speaking of a head being the shape of an egg, Rob, how was your week?
Well, I think it rained. I seem to recall rain falling sometime this week. And I remember sleeping some. And then I was eating some food. It wasn't food of my choosing. It was food of someone else's choosing. And I thought, gosh, I don't like this. And I would not normally choose to put this in my mouth. Yet here it is. And I'm putting it in my mouth. And then after the food, I didn't like
it. Have you ever not wanted to put something in your mouth that was forced in your mouth?
No, but occasionally if you're out riding a bicycle with your mouth open, you'll get bugs.
I just remember a time in high school when they were doing some sort of initiation prank and somebody puts something in your mouth that you just didn't want it in your mouth.
No, it certainly
was long.
It certainly wasn't something I was going to swallow.
Okay, we got to move on. Now, this week, I've been debating whether I wanted to do this next segment on Beatles solo albums rated from worst to best according to the Ultimate Classic Rock website. How come every show I have to sneeze? At one point during the show I have to sneeze, but I never do.
It's the insulation they use for the shack. And now they're pulling
it apart.
I didn't
know he used insulation for the shack. We don't have to worry about that anymore after today's show.
Nope, dynamite.
Anyways,
settles it all.
As I tried to ward off this sneeze. But I decided today, well, what the hell. We will see how it goes on this, I don't know. It's going to be different.
Yeah.
That I was going to say, oh, this is number so-so. I'm not going to do that.
No.
You're going to see what I'm going to do in a few seconds.
I'm watching.
Okay. I also decided to do it because I promised everybody I would do it on our last episode. And I always keep my promises.
They're going to call you Big Walter if you don't.
Oh, yes. You know my promises are always kept. I am not a Welcher.
They are kept when remembered.
What was that?
The promises are kept when remembered.
Oh, it is. Actually, that is very true. Yeah. We have a memory, both of us, that goes in and out.
Yeah. And other people put a lot of importance on memory. I don't. Or do
no,
I?
No, you don't put importance on
memory. I don't remember.
Anything. Interesting. in that on this Beatles solo albums from worst to best, it has 65 solo Beatles albums. But this is where I have my complaints, and it's like the complaint I talked about last week, not last week, but last episode about the other worst to best of Beatles solo albums, is that they like to not include some albums, which I say a boogie woogie to that.
Yeah, why are they doing that?
I don't
know. I smell payola.
And you know what? There's like, I'm not sure how many. I actually counted it once, but I can't remember. But I know it was in the 90s. Can you imagine that? Like 95 or something Beatles solo albums. That's including live albums. Not including greatest hits packages, because they don't count. But pretty much including everything except greatest hits packages. Like there's 95 Beatles solo albums.
That's more than 20 per Beatle.
Yeah, but that's not true.
Because some did more than others.
Because some have lived a little bit longer than others. But because Ringo's had a plethora of albums, which is why he's always got his albums bunched up at the end. And I'm going to tell you something. Ringo's albums all through his career, except for like the late 70s, they've been like good. They've not been great. They've not been, you know, below average.
Quality.
They've been Ringo quality. They've been a solid 3 stars every time. Some people might disagree with that, you know, once or twice or whatever. But I just think it gets rated lower because he has so many albums. So if you got a 3-star like John Lennon Mind Games compared to a 3-star Ringo Starr album from 2012, you're going to say, well, it's Ringo Starr. I'm going to put farther down on the list just because... what does
people
he care?
Have heard of Mind Games. People have not heard of Ringo's new album.
So in other words, when I was looking at this list, I said, I don't like this. I just think it's kind of correct, but it's kind of wrong. And again, what they did include the albums with Yoko Ono and John Lennon. But they didn't include the experimental avant-garde albums that they did before the Beatles actually broke up. Now, the interesting thing is, an album's an album, and I don't see the difference. If you release an album, whether it's experimental or not, it fucking counts. You can't say, well, you know, you can't count that album that I released, man, because it's experimental. All of a sudden, you get an excuse if it's experimental. I should make a really good pop album.
Some of these were too commercial.
And just say, that was actually all experimental. So you can't count it as a bad review. I don't like that. I think that's bullshit. So I'm going to do a little thing here. Since they didn't do that last week with John Lennon's albums, because he did his experimental albums with Yoko Ono and whatever. They didn't do George Harrison's electronic sound on this one either. I'm going to review it. I'm going to review them really quickly. The John Lennon albums, 2 versions, Unfinished Music number 1, Life of the Lions, Unfinished Music number 2, and Wedding Album are, let's see, pieces of crap. You know the pieces of crap that not only that your dog like leaves on the ground, but then you don't pick it up for like a week?
Yeah, and like the flies won't even touch it.
No, the flies don't like it.
They hate it. That's too crappy for us.
That's like listening to these albums. Because I have listened to these albums more than once. I have bought these albums. I have 2 versions, which is not a first issue, but I have an expensive copy. I have a first issue of Life for the Lions, which is very expensive. And I have a Japanese issue of the Wedding Album, which has all the stuff like the fake cake and all that from their wedding. And I've listened to them, and I have tried. Oh, Lord, I have tried.
I think you probably prefer Cheech and Chong's Wedding Album.
And what I I have surmised like Two Virgins is just like, it's just like a bunch of tapes and then that they got together. First time they got together, basically John and Yoko, that first night that they got together, she came over and John said, do you want to hear some experimental tapes I've been working on? And then they listened to it, then she'd sing a little bit on it, and then he'd add some more shit on it. Like, that's fine for a night, like a party tape or whatever.
Yeah.
But to waste vinyl on it and release it is something that I'm always against. Like, I know the Beatles have their own record company, Apple, so they're not depriving anybody because it's their own record label so that they can, whatever.
They're paying for it.
They're paying for it. But you're paying for it when you have to listen to that kind of shit.
If you purchased it in the store.
Yes.
Yeah.
I'll tell you right now, Two Virgins gets like zero. It gets like no stars. It's a bomb. It gets nothing. Now, Life of the Lions gets a little bit better because other than the first 25 minutes, 25 minutes, of a concert in Cambridge in 1969 where Yoko came up and just screamed for 25 minutes and John was there to accompany her on feedback guitar. Oh, what a pleasure. That is so pretentious. Oh my God, that's so fucking pretentious. And then the B-side, though, is interesting because Yoko had a miscarriage in, like, November of 1968. And so she was at the hospital, and John brought a recorder to kind of record what was going on. And they record the baby's heartbeat, and then it stops. That's actually quite moving. It is. They record the baby's heartbeat, and then it just, after about 2 minutes, and then it ends. It's very actually moving because you actually whatever, and Yoko sings a very nice song from what the paper has. The paper has, like, they couldn't find a bed for John to sit in beside Yoko while she was in the hospital, so he laid down on the floor and they got him some what do you call those sheets?
Blankets that you lie blankets on.
And so she just sang. Right from the paper, and it's a very sweet song about no bed for Beetle John, and right from the paper. And then, of course, it's ruined by like 12 minutes of John playing with the radio dial. I mean, fuck me, that's so pretentious. Who wants to, I could do that at home. Who wants to hear somebody go on the radio dial? Fuck me.
I think there may have been drugs involved.
There may have been, no, because you're in the hospital. So what it is that there's definitely some pretentiousness involved in that what you're doing is art. And just because you think of something stupid and then put that stupidness on an album doesn't make it art. It just makes it a waste of wax.
Yeah, that goes beyond testing your limits.
But then we get to the worst of all, which is the Wedding album, which has side A, which is another like interminable, like 25 minutes or something. The side is all one thing. It's called John and Yoko, and all it is John and Yoko calling each other their names. Yoko, John, in various tones. Oh my God, stimulating. Fuck. Like, how, only fuck. And then on side B is kind of interesting because it has 25 minutes of like prep, them in bed and the people talking to them, asking them questions in their bed and that's kind of interesting. But it still gets like no stars. It gets like bomb, zero, nothing, because it's a useless piece of document of two being people being pretentious. And I don't have any sympathy for, I like experimentation. But I like experimentation with a reason and with smartness. I don't like experimentation that I can think of really quickly. Like,
we could record ourselves before the show and play that as an album.
Well, we could record ourselves banging these microphones against the wall, and that's side A. We do that for 20 minutes. See, and that's seriously what they're doing.
That's where the drugs come in. Something that could only be interesting with chemical assistance.
Okay, I do agree with that. And it's just utterly pretentious to the point of, I just don't know what to the point is. It's just one of the most aggravating things, and even to call it experimental or avant-garde is doesn't do justice to people who actually do experimental music all their lives and take it very seriously. This is just people fooling around and calling it art. That's all it is. Fuck. Same thing goes for George Harrison's electronic sound. I like his Wonderwall soundtrack a little bit because it's a soundtrack for one thing. It's got music. It's got some music that's kind of good, and it's got some music that's kind of boring. And overall, it's kind of a 2.5 album, but 2.5 star album. But I just, again, don't see the real point of it. It's nice, but it's kind of like a lot of soundtrack albums. It's just there's a lot of just stuff that should have remained unrecorded. And then electronic sound, which I said before, my brother bought when it was a very rare record, and hearing that as a 14-year-old with just a bunch of bloops and burps from the synthesizer,
and experiment on your own time.
Experiment on your own time. Why not only spend money that you know it's not going to sell, except to Beatle fanatics? Why are you spending all of this money on your pretty much homegrown whim when you could just, I got a cassette of this and I can play this sometimes? And why release it?
That's the thing, is showing it to other people.
Now, if you're wondering, like this, and this is something I just kind of came up with this week, is if you're wondering, well, why didn't the Beatles, like why didn't John and George, before the Beatles broke up, release like regular rock solo albums or pop solo albums? And an interesting question that was actually answered when I was watching the Get Back documentary a couple years ago, or last year, I can't fucking remember. I guess 2 years ago almost. And George said, like, you know what I'd like to do? I'd like to do an album of my own, of my songs, and then I could come back and do a Beatle album. So what he's saying is, I guess at that time, people didn't make solo albums. That didn't happen yet. Because if you made a solo album, why not just incorporate your songs with the band, right? It wasn't like a heavy feature. So I guess it was like, I don't know if the band decided this or if it was an unwritten rule or something. But if you're going to make an album, a solo album, it'd have to be a non-pop rock record.
That's a silly rule.
And yes, it is. But I don't think it was something that that bands did a lot. I'm trying to think now that this has come up.
No, when Rod Stewart did his solo.
Yeah, but that was about 69, the 70? Same time as the Beatles broke up, 69. Mm. So
that started happening around that time.
And George was going to do it. I think if the Beatles stayed together, he would have made a solo album, and then he would have made a Beatles album. That was his plan. He even talked about it in the movie, and it was very interesting. But that was not part of the plan. If you were going to make a solo album, it had to be experimental. It couldn't be a pop rock record, in other words. And it's interesting that when Ringo did his, he didn't do that either. As you know, he made a traditional album, standards, and he made a country album. Mm-hmm. And so the first real pop rock record was the McCartney solo album, which was the album that he declared that he was leaving the Beatles. So it's interesting that it actually took, the first pop rock album was the one that was made specifically for after the Beatles. And then they all kind of started making their albums. But I just find that, you know, if you're going to fuck around, best to just keep a tape of it. I'm very serious. I know that it was the 60s and it's not, you know, 2023 is very different. And it's very much more critical of stuff like that. And if you're a big star, you can use it. But I know if you're not in the time, you don't understand. I understand that completely.
You do stuff like that, you're looking for a listener who's on the same chemical wavelength as you.
Yes, drugs were taken back then. And you're looking for... There's a lot of experimental stuff going on in rock because there's so many uncarved or unmade things yet. That
people were
that
starting to do new stuff and realize they could break away from...
Yeah, everything. So taking that into account, it makes it a little bit more acceptable. I just find these homegrown pretentious things to be insulting to almost everything and everybody involved, the listener, the record company, the performer. Nobody gets off the hook on these things. Anyways, these don't even count in the list. I don't think the list... See, a lot of albums I can't even talk about because we're going to review them. So, blah, blah, blah. Interesting that the top... you know what? We did last week. We did Beaucoup à Blue. Not last week, but the last episode.
Yeah.
We did Beaucoup à Blue. Now, I'm just checking because I actually think that other than the Ringo album, is the best rated. Other than two albums, I think Beaucoup à Blue is Ringo's highest position, other than those two albums. I mean, I'm just checking just to make sure. While I'm checking, Rob is going to tell you a story about how he was at the Beaucoup à Blue sessions, weren't you, for a day?
I was. I remember there was a cat, and there was a falcon, and...
Here's a cat in the studio. I remember that so well. Don't remember Ringo. I didn't see him there.
I've been in a lot of studios with a lot of famous musicians. That was the only time I ever saw a cat. And I was wondering, what's that cat doing there? Does the cat interfere with the recording? No, he's usually pretty quiet. Well, doesn't the hair get on the tapes? I don't get it.
Okay, so Beaucoup à Blue came in number 28, which is out of 65 albums, is really, really good. And it came in just ahead, of Red Rose Speedway, which came in at number 27 best album. Very interesting. I'm just looking now to see that's right. It became in as the third best Ringo album of all that he's released that they thought of in Ultimate Classic Rock website. And very interesting, of course. And I'll give you some of the top 10 here. They got there's some really good Beatles solo albums. You look at the top 20 and you go, holy shit. Can't say that. Living in the Material World came in number seventh greatest solo Beatle album. That's very good. Very good. Can't say that yet. Band on the Run. Again, the top three albums were the ones that we debated before. Band on the Run came in number three, which we voted number one. Plastic Ono Band album came in number two. And as usual, it seems, All Things Must Pass came in as the greatest Beatles solo album.
Double Fantasy come in? Was that good?
Double Fantasy, which we can't review that album, obviously.
No, it's not reviewing. I'm just on the list.
I just want to say that I bought that album. Of course, it was my first John Lennon album that he released on time, because I started listening in 1977, and he, of course, was semi-retired. And then he released it. Of course, it was big news. Fuck, it was big news back then when he released it. I bought it the first week. I still, to this day, think it's a 5-star record. I love Yoko's songs on it almost as much as John's. That's why it's such a great record, is that there's never a real weak spot on it. Comes in number 16. I don't agree with that, but there's a lot of things. It's all subjective, you know. So I would put it in. Of course, I'd have to look at all. There's so many. So I'd have to look at them before. I know what the top five are for Beatles solo albums that I would pick. But other than that, I'd have to look at all of them and
they
see.
They had Wings albums on this, but they didn't have any Traveling Wilburys, did they?
No. Well, that's.
You know, wasn't a real band.
Well, no, that's not that. Come on, Rob. That's songs written by other people too, not just George. Like, the George solo album is a solo album, and he's in a band called The Traveling Wilburys, where everybody's writing songs and people are singing different songs. And
Wings started out that way, but they shifted away.
Yeah, but they were pretty much Paul McCartney's band, if you understand. Like, Paul McCartney was the leader. George Harrison was not the leader. Nobody was really the leader of the Traveling Wilburys. It was very much a super group.
Yeah. You know, I prefer the super groups to the made up groups.
To the made up groups?
The made up
groups. I don't know what that means.
Nobody does.
So that's that. I promised to do it. I know I didn't do it the way people wanted to, but...
it's done. It's out of the way. You can't fault him for it.
You know, you can't fault me. You can't go back and say, you didn't do that thing. And I said, no, I did that thing. I just did it the way I felt that it should be done.
A bunch of other things I said I was going to do and haven't done, but not this
one. Oh, my God. If you could count the things that I promised to do and didn't do, I would be here for a long time. Rob. A
very long time. Don't make me use...
Don't do that. Nobody can see that, so they don't know what I'm laughing at, so don't do that.
The shaker.
Yeah, the shaker. Okay, they can't even hear that, so don't do that. People don't like to think about what you... Don't, Rob, because people are going to get pissed off. They're going to say, well, what's he doing? Is he a goof?
A bunch of percussive instruments around me within arm's reach. I get oh so terribly bored at these shows.
Okay, so this week we are reviewing the Tina Turner album... Second solo album, Acid Queen, released in 1975. Still, it's the album she released, the last album she released while she was still with Ike. Still a solo album, but we'll get to all that. It's complicated, blah, blah, blah. And there's even more complication. Like, I don't want to get too much into this. Because Tina is, you should know a lot about Tina already. She's legendary. And she's lived a legendary life. But there's so many, I wanted to pull up a thing here, but I didn't.
You need another tab, my friend.
I forgot a tab. I did.
Well, allow me to entertain the audience with tales of the mundane.
One of the things, like I can even say that Tina Turner was born in 1939 as Anna Mae Bullock.
Oh, yeah.
But that's not for sure. And you know why?
She was from Nutbush, Tennessee? Flatbush, Tennessee?
Yeah, what's your point?
Okay.
What, do you think she was Tina Nutbush? no, because Ike said that wasn't her real name. And then there were actual documents that she signed... under this other name. This story is just like, what? It's a fascinating story that, of course, we can't get all into all the
it's too little long.
Things about it. But it's just like when you think you know about what's going on in this story, then there's Ike's point of view, and he has evidence. There's Tina's point of view, which she has evidence, which is her, you know, black and blue face half the time. But Ike was also brilliant. That's another thing that you got to take into consideration. But you can't forget about the fact that Ike did all this terrible stuff to Tina. And you can't display the fact that not only was he high most of the time on cocaine, that's not an excuse, but he's also, in his later life, was finally diagnosed as being bipolar and schizophrenic, which, of course... You know, if you're, and I'm not saying that what he did was right, because obviously what
you're
he
just
did
saying to Tina was not. There's other factors other than just pure evil meanness.
Yes, it's not just some guy who's evil. Like Rob said, a very good point. And if we're supposed to have all this mental illness awareness and sympathy, then you also have to have the same sympathy in your own way. Even when they do bad things, because when all that is not treated, and they don't even, because you don't treat, it was hard to treat
no,
stuff like
he,
that.
No, he didn't talk about stuff like that.
Yeah, he didn't even talk about it. Then at least it gives people the knowledge that it wasn't just Ike being an asshole. He was being an asshole because of external forces. Because
he was up and down and all over the place.
Yes. Again, but still not saying that it's all right, but... Everybody for the last, I don't know, 30 years ever since that Tina wrote her book and everything and the movie came out have been saying like Ike's like a monster. And yes, he acted like a monster, but maybe there was a reason behind it, not just him being like one of the worst men in the world. That's all I'm saying. I wanted to find that thing, but I can't really find it. Anyways,
it exists.
It does exist. A thing that
we haven't found. It's real. We've seen it.
There's so much.
We didn't just dream it. There's more to come.
There's more to come
in the future.
So, anyways, we will say that she was born Anna Mae Bullock, actually in Brownsville, Tennessee, but lived in Nutbush. One of my favorite rock songs from the early 70s, not Bush City Limits. Sorry.
That's why I first heard the Nutbush. Yep. That song, yeah.
And I think I heard that song when I was a little boy on one, because Ike and Turner, as Tina would be, was on a lot of variety shows. And I heard them perform Nutbush City Limits in the early 70s when they were still together. And then I definitely heard it when she did like the Cher show and like Donny and Marie and all that crap, because she had to pay bills. And so anyways, you all know, you know, she hooked up with Ike and she made her first recording or first singing on an Ike record in 1958. Now, this means that Tina was in that first generation of rockers. Mm-hmm. She is almost the last person standing. Everybody says, well, Jerry Lee Lewis was the last person standing. You could almost say that Tina was the last person. She goes all the way back to 1958, by God. But her first real record of singing under her own name was in 1960 with Ike. And we're not going to get into all that stuff. They just saying that, you know, Ike and Tina were together and very successful. Not selling an overabundance of records. They did most of their money from touring. They had a great live act. One of the best live acts there is.
You can kind of figure that out from how comfortable they are doing shows like, you know, 60s and 70s.
Yes.
Like, you knew by the late 60s or 70s, they've been doing it for quite a while.
Oh, yes. And, it was professional.
Very good
at
what they were doing.
It was rock and roll. It was soul. It was all those things. It was exciting to watch. They toured all the time. That's where they made their money. Their records, of course, you know, songs like Nutbush City Limits and Proud Mary and all that, you know, and River Deep Mountain High, you know, they sold well, but they didn't, that's not where they made their money. Their fortune was made in touring, and everybody wanted to book them because they would bring the house down. Not saying that the records weren't good, because the records were, it's just that they were spotty. And that they always had like 3-star records, but it was always like, because they made so many, like every like 4 albums a year at 28 minutes long, you know what I mean? And different record labels and stuff like that. Anyways, by the time Tina, I don't really know why Tina, it was Ike's idea or whatever, but Tina made her first solo album, which was a country album, doing country songs. In 1974, and that led to this album in 1975, Acid Queen. And then she left in 1976. Ike beat her up pretty bad. They were about to sign a TV contract for some shows, TV shows, and the day before, Ike beat her up pretty bad, and she said, I've had enough, and she left. She left with literally cents in her pockets. Literally like 20 cents in her pocket. And that's it, and her kids. And that was it. And she went to live with her friend Anne Margaret for a little bit until she could get on her feet. And then she had all these debts from the IRS and from all these gigs that she had to cancel that they had booked. And it took her, almost until Private Dancer came along to pay all those debts off. That's why she had to do it like Hollywood Squares and all those kind of shows and do Vegas. And what I'm getting to is we're coming to the point where we have kind of a nostalgia act. We have a washed up performer. She released 4 solo albums, 2 with Ike and 2 after she left Ike, in 1978-79, the last one, didn't even get released to North America, which is pretty sad. And then there was no albums until Private Dancer. There was no albums for 5 years from Tina. And she was a has-been. I hate to say it. She was doing Vegas, and she was doing TV shows whenever she could get it. And nobody ever thought that she'd do anything. I know I didn't. I just thought that she'd appear on shows, and even then, variety shows were dying. So, Tina Turner, she was great. She was great, wasn't she? And then I saw, and I'll never forget this, she recorded two songs. It was kind of like a test single. She recorded Al Green's Let's Stay Together in 1983. And I saw the video of this. And it's funny because you didn't really release a song with just by itself. But I guess Capitol Records wanted to see like what she was going to do. And it's a perfect song for Tina's voice. And Tina was a rocker. Tina didn't want to have anything to do with like soul or rhythm and blues. I don't know if it was because of Ike, but she was always complaining, I want to do rock and roll, and you'll give me this and give me that. But Let's Stay Together was such a perfect song for her. I saw the video, I remember, in 1983, and I said, whoa, this, I remember. I saw it on some cheesy video show in 1983, and I said, this is really good. Like, this is the kind of music that could get Tina Turner going again. But there's no way. Comebacks at 45 or whatever don't happen.
Yeah.
It'd be a miracle. She's just going to sell to Tina Turner fans, and that's it.
50s and 60s stars are really making comebacks.
Nobody does.
They've still been... Well, yeah. The ones that were still going didn't need to make comebacks, really, because they were still going.
That's right. And they make their money from their all the guys, Jerry Lee Lewis and Chuck Berry, from their...
doing the concerts.
Yeah, the touring all year. And they're making a great living, and they don't want to really
play the
music or update their music. They like the music that they played. Elvis was the only one who changed his music, and he was successful throughout his career. So it was a no-brainer that she was going to go nowhere. Except Tina's Tina, and she had a good management in Roger Davies. I think I got the name right.
Let's pretend you're doing gig on
this. Yeah, and... who signed with Capitol Records, and then people wanted to help her out. Mark Knopfler wanted to produce, and Dire Straits was on two songs. And she came along at the right moment with this right out. Greatest. Rolling Stone pisses me off. Because we did the Living in the Material World album, and then the day before we did it, I told you this, Rob, they came out with that article about, the 50th anniversary of Living in the Material World. I was like, it was my idea first. And then, not that this is my idea, because we're doing this because Tina passed and the world is mourning, but just as I was getting ready to finish up all my stuff that I was getting ready for this episode yesterday, Rolling Stone had an article on, the greatest, they call it the greatest pop comeback of all time. I call it one of the greatest music comebacks of all time. It was literally impossible at that time, especially after not releasing a record. You have to understand, to not release an album in 5 years, it's like not releasing an album in 15 or 20 years back then. So, but then, everything aligned. And what aligned was how Tina looked. She had the big hair now.
Yep. That was the first time I'd seen the spiky hair.
Oh, and she looked beautiful.
And then lots of the gals started having the spiky hair.
Didn't she? She's 45 years old, and she looked beautiful. I mean, not that she didn't look beautiful, but she looked more beautiful than she's ever looked. She's singing straight now instead of the heavy shouting, vocalizing type of thing she was doing before, which was perfect for the time. And MTV,
yep.
God, when What's Love Got to Do With It got on, and it was just a perfect amalgamation of Tina at that time and the song and every song that she did with every video. Seems like Tina was made for videos. It made Private Dancer not only the biggest comeback album of all time, but it is one of the biggest albums of all time.
I had to click on the Acid Queen version from the Tommy there when we started to, when I found out we were doing this album, and her performance there was riveting. Like, you couldn't take your eyes off her.
Great performer, great singer. Very emotive in her Ike years. And that could be a detriment. As far, she was much more, by 1984, they were telling her, you need to sing more. And you can tell that by every song she does, like What's Love Got to Do With It, and all these songs that We Don't Need Another Hero, where she's singing. She's not like yelling. Oh, and yeah, I don't mean that in a bad way, but you can't do that now.
No, okay? She was, when she sings on this album, at least, I know it sounds like she's doing a live show.
Yeah.
And that's what I suspect a lot of her earlier stuff was like.
Now, Rob's going to review this album first.
Didn't I review Ringo first?
Do you want me to go first?
I think I reviewed Ringo. I don't remember. Ah, I have no memory. You want me to review it first? I'll review it first, mister.
You want me to review it first? Okay.
No, I want you to review it first.
Okay, I'll review it first. Oh, I just want to say that first thing that ever happened on this show, this happened this week. I'm going to tell you what happened. I had to, as usual, I had to pick an album. And I was not particularly, I didn't hear all her solo albums, but garnering what I had established, I wasn't going to pick her first album, which was the country music, because that's not indicative of her music or Tina. And our basis for picking albums on this show, as Rob knows, is we try and pick an album that's indicative of the artist, so that when you, if you want to buy the album as a listener, you know that that's a very typical of that artist.
And maybe later on you get into their non-typical albums.
And then her other two albums she released, I'm not talking now about Acid Queen, I'm talking about the two albums she released in 1978 and 79, didn't get good reviews. It didn't seem like this, like it was just, I don't know, I didn't really look up Acid Queen. But it just seemed like, you know, this is not a good time or very indicative to be in it, to doing a Tina Turner album. So I said, well, I'm going to do an Ike and Turner album, Tina Turner album. So I actually picked one. And last week, I actually did something that I've never done before. I listened to the record. I'm not going to tell you what Ike and Tina Turner album I picked, but I listened to the record. And about a quarter of the way through it, I was going, this ain't right. And right at the end of it, I just had a bad feeling. Not at the quality of the music. Not at all.
Something was off about the albums?
Something was off about picking an Ike and Tina album.
Oh, yeah.
But I did decide right away. Yes, I didn't decide right away. But I left it for that night. And the next day, and I really had a bad taste in my mouth about, I can't pick anything else because I don't think this is right. This is supposed to be about Tina because Tina passed away. And so the next day, and I've never played an album already and then changed. I've never done that. The next day, for some reason, I was just looking up Tina Turner and just seeing, just seeing what I could find information-wise that I didn't already know. This album popped up, Acid Queen. And I'm telling you, I could hear Tina whisper in my ear, do that one. I'm telling you, I know there's been a lot of strange instances that I have brought up many times since we started this show. And there have been. I'm not bullshitting about any of them. I really felt that Tina said, this one, don't do that last one. That's not right. I kind of felt that vibe from her when I was listening to that album. And I'm not bullshitting. I'm not trying to say that I'm talking to Tina, but I do feel that, this is a popular show and Tina's probably saying, don't do it, that Ike album with me. That's not the one. I do feel that as soon as I came upon Acid Queen, I said, and I paused for a second and I heard like, yeah, do that one.
Have you ever heard anything off Acid Queen before?
Nothing.
Yeah, me neither.
Except for of course the song on the Tommy soundtrack. I had never heard anything off Acid Queen before. I thought, you know what? I don't know. This is beforehand. I thought, you know what? All of her albums probably stink from the late 70s until her Private Dancer thing. And I didn't want to sully her reputation by doing a poor solo album. But it was, I swear, it was Tina who told me, don't do that album.
Do this one.
Do my solo album, this one. So I did. And first time I listened to it, I liked it. Very rock and roll.
That's what surprised me. I was expecting less rock and roll. I was thinking more in line like blues and R&B, but...
Because you know what?
This definitely was in the rock and roll category.
The album that I had listened to, which I'm not going to name, because we might actually do that album when we do Ike and Tina Turner, because we have to do Ike and Tina Turner album at some point, was a lot more rougher, a lot more emoting from Tina. The production was a lot tougher, a lot more soul, a lot more rock, but you know what? Not so slick. But I expected her albums to be too slick. You know what I mean? Like late 70s.
Overproduced and relying heavily upon the strings.
That was my preconception, which of course we're supposed to never have preconceptions. Yeah,
and that did happen to quite a few artists at that time. They got syrupy production.
So I came in and first of all, I listened to it the first time and I said, oh, I'm very surprised. This is a good album. This is my first listen. I like this. This is a good album. And, oh, I should say that there's the first side. This is very important. Let me pull this up here so that I can do this
properly. Don't pull it out.
The first side is all British rock covers on purpose. Kind of like a theme for some reason. Under My Thumb, Let's Spend the Night Together by the Stones, a reworking of Acid Queen, and I Can See for Miles by The Who, and Whole Lotta Love by Led Zeppelin. Now on side B, and the first side is produced by Bring It Up Gary.
By that guy.
No, it's produced by two guys. Danny Biante and I'm sorry, I just can't have everything at the tip of my fingers here. I should just go right to the beginning. The first side was produced by Danny Biante and Spencer Proffer. And the second side was very much Ike's. All the songs were written by Ike. By the way, if people don't know this, Tina wrote a lot of her songs with Ike and Tina Turner. In fact, the album I was going to do, half the songs were written by Tina. So if anybody thinks that Ike is the sole musical intelligence of Ike and Tina Turner, they're seriously wrong. But anyways, Ike wrote all the songs on the second side, and he produced it. And in fact, the very last chart single that they ever released was from this album, the first song on the side B, Baby Get It On, even has Ike's lead vocals on it.
Yeah.
Which is funny, because it's a Tina Turner solo album. But you still get through all of the album feeling that Tina is in charge. You just get that impression.
Yeah, I at first I thought, you know, okay, this is going to be all Ike and Tina, but he was just a guest on that one song, because I was listening to the other three.
And, he was, yeah. And
it's just Tina.
So I listened to this album the second time, and I said, I really like this album. This is a very good album. This is a very good album. I'm very surprised that this is a very good album. I'm pleasantly surprised.
I didn't know what to expect.
Pleasantly surprised. Then I listened to it the third time. And the third time, I said, this is a fucking excellent album. This is an excellent album. And I am not wavering from that, because holy smokes. First off, the production on this is brilliant.
Yeah.
On both sides, by both the two white guys.
Talent and imagination.
Who I can't remember their names. I'm not going to keep on looking them up. Are very intelligent and smart on the A side. And Ike's production on side two is just as brilliant.
Yeah.
It's the kind of music I like. It's the soul music with the strings and the dynamics. Oh, Rob knows how I love dynamics. Dynamics is all through this record. It rocks like a son of a bitch when it has to. And
the players are good.
Yes, the players are good. And by the way, since Rob brought that up, one of the guitarists on this is Ray Parker Jr.
Ray Parker Jr.
plays some scintillating lead guitar on this, just like he did on the Stevie Wonder record, Talking Book, which we reviewed. And also Kim Carnes.
Kim Carnes, I saw her name in the background vocals.
Backup vocals, which, and Tom Scott does saxophone. Everybody knows Tom Scott from 6,000 recording sessions. And just a great band. So I would like to go song by song really quickly. But I'm going to tell you right now, I love this record. And I am so stoked because I thought it was going to be at least very average. At best, very average. And here, this album is knocked my socks off. I was looking for socks. I couldn't find any socks.
No socks anywhere. The few socks he did have had been blown right off.
I only had, at that time, those two pairs of socks, and they got blown right off, and I never did find one.
Never found it. They're up in a tree.
I love the version of Under My Thumb. I just thought that it was a brilliant arrangement by the guys.
And the synthesizer, the way they use it on this album, it really, it's incredible, especially for that year.
And they don't use it like a Pete Townsend would use it all over the ground, like a quadrophenia.
No, it would like come in at the beginning and really play a powerful two-bar
yes.
thing.
And then
the singing
know it's
would
there.
Come in. And yeah.
But you know it's there, but you hardly know it's there. You know it's there subconsciously. After that,
yeah, the only one I really heard it again consciously after that was, by golly, Bootsy Whitelaw on the second side had that cool echo synthesizer. Yeah. Wow, that was cool.
I think Bootsy Whitelaw also does the thing too. I'm not sure which song. There are two songs that does that, which is kind of cool.
Yeah,
but you can, the thing that's brilliant about it is that, like I just said, the keyboards and the synthesizer are there. But you only subconsciously hear it. But what you subconsciously hear is great stuff.
Yeah.
It's nicely produced. It's, what I meant was, it's, I didn't mean that actually. It is nicely produced. The whole album is brilliantly produced. But it sounds good. It's engineered good. And everything sounds perfect. You know, everything is at the minute or at the second you're listening to it is as loud as it's supposed to be. Which means sometimes when it stops, the drums come in at the right sound. And that is hard to do, but this is...
When you get all talented people doing something, you can't get something like this unless you have all talented people.
Yes, and you can tell that there are all talented people working definitely behind the scenes, but of course in front of the scenes with the making of the music and with Tina's vocals. It's just, wow, I'm surprised at how great and excellent this album is. Under My Thumb really did... blow my socks off. It was just like, wow, oh man. Let's Spend the Night Together was kind of middling about this, and then I liked it. It was kind of like soul. And
it was.
I liked that it was that she changed it instead of a rock number, which I was never even a fan of as a rock number by the Stones. And in the cover versions I had heard before, it never did much for me. But this one kind of did. It was soulful, and it's really cool to hear a woman sing "Let's Spend the Night Together." You don't know that unless you hear it, but
yeah, the same thing occurs on a Whole Lot of Love.
Yes, yes, we will get to that. But Rob makes a very good point. I really like that it's from a woman's point of view because it's so sexy.
And that R&B feel to it, like that's one of the things I loved about this whole first side is none of these songs. Sounds like the original. They are all a unique take on the
It
music.
Is a unique take. I did. Well, we'll get to that. I loved Acid Queen. I actually like... They did Acid Queen twice. They did it for the Tommy soundtrack with The Who. And they did it in Tina's own version for this album. And I actually like this version more than the Tommy version. I really like like Rob said, the R&B flavor of it. And the kind of more laid back. But then there's these power chords at the end. It's kind of a mixture of R&B and The Who. And I was just... And I thought that Tina's vocals, which were really sung emotively for the Tommy soundtrack, was a lot more R&B and soul based, which just mean a lot more laid back instead of screaming. And I really like that. I was really hypnotically drawn to this version.
This was probably my favorite song on this side of the album. But
oh, really?
I liked them all. Let's Spend the Night Together.
Okay.
Yeah.
You know, I have to disagree a little
bit. The I did only not, reason, I think it was just so different. It sounded like, if I didn't know this was the Rolling Stones, if I never heard that version, I would say this is an Ike and Tina song. They wrote it.
Yeah. But just to have the bass there, like when she's singing, and you know I love that stuff, when you sing like two verses and all of a sudden just the bass go, and it's just
the bass
like,
and the drums.
To me, that's just like that smartness. For one, you're not just playing the song all the way through. You're dividing it into sections to capture the attention of the audience. Then you'll have the strings coming. Yes. Oh, just like fucking brilliant stuff. The only thing that I just thought that it was kind of I just didn't think that I Can See for Miles worked for me.
No, I Can See for Miles. That's I thought that was the weakest on the side.
I thought it was the weakest on the side. It wasn't terrible.
It's still not too bad.
But I thought that it was the one song that didn't live up to the potential of the other songs on this first side. Yeah. And so it was almost on the first two listens forgettable, but by the third or fourth listen I was going, yeah, I like it, but it's not great, but I like it.
Yeah, I didn't think it was inappropriate for her voice. I think I thought it was inappropriate for her style.
I thought it was actually inappropriate for the point of view. This was actually the one song where I thought that this is a very man thing, that I Can See for Miles thing, where that would be a man going and spying, and I Can See for Miles, I Can See What You're Doing, where a woman is more like combative. Like, I know you're cheating on me, and I'm going to hit you in the head.
A little more angry. Yeah.
So I didn't think that kind of suited her. But anyways, it still was pleasant. But then, I think the killer of the album, the killer of the album on this side, anyway, maybe the killer of the album for me overall, I don't know, it's kind of tied between this and Baby Get It On, which was just, Whole Lot of Love is a combination of Led Zeppelin and The Temptations, Papa Was a Rolling Stone, and Isaac Hayes, and holy fuck, if you think that song can't be done other than Led Zeppelin, you haven't heard this version. No,
it's closer to Kashmir than it is to Whole Lot of Love.
It is.
But it's, it's cool.
It is so cool. Hard to describe, but there's strings in it. Like you say, like Kashmir, there's strings. It's got the soul strings like Papa Was a Rolling Stone, where it comes in and then it leaves.
And it goes, it would be like fast strings and then that slow lingering note.
Yes, the slow lingering note. And yes, as Rob was pointing out earlier, it is so cool to hear a woman sing, Whole Lot of Love, I Want Every Inch of
Every inch of your love.
Has a different
meaning.
Wait
a second. When Robert Plant says that, I'm going to give
when
every inch
Robert,
I expect it.
Yes.
Whoa.
No, but see, when Robert Plant says, I want every inch of your love, it doesn't mean that. It means
I want every part of your love. No, when he says, I'm going to give you every inch of my love.
Yeah, exactly.
But she says, I want every inch of your love.
Whoa, that's different.
All right. You've got my attention, Miss Turner.
You got my attention. Hello. And that totally changes the thing. And that's even a little bit. It's really the music of this that knocks it out. But Tina's vocal. And then you know that they're making a serious record and it's not slock like they would make, like I thought they would make for an album like this with Tina Turner.
I wasn't expecting it to rock like this.
Because the vocals come back in an artful way, which they don't do if you're just making a product, like I thought they would for Tina's solo albums in the late 70s. I love how you think the song's over, just like in the original Whole Lot of Love with Led Zeppelin, and then the vocals come back. Whole Lot of Love. I just said, that's got to be the icing on the cake right there for that song. I thought it was, I don't know, I heard it the first time and I loved it, and it's gotten better every time. I just think it's a soul classic. And I don't know how this album
got over.
I've only done half the album so far. And already I'm saying, I don't know how this album got ignored and didn't sell. I think this is so good. And this is only the songs, like
the cover songs.
Yeah. And I thought that she would like Vegas all these songs. And they're not Vegas at all. My God. She would, unfortunately. She would do... that's why I was so scared, because she did do Disco Inferno on her next solo album. I think not having Ike did actually make a big difference. I can't really say, because I haven't heard those two albums that she did before she took her 5-year break, but I could just see the songs she did, and it's like,
We might have been being steered in unwise directions yes. by unscrupulous record company folk.
And maybe not knowing how what direction she wanted to go into. I don't know.
But yeah, I mean, you put this much effort into an album like this and it doesn't get recognition, then what do you do? This is the right direction, but it was not the right direction. What's she left to believe?
I know, exactly. What is she left to believe? And we got the second side. And now we're rocking. First of all, Ike is writing songs. Fuck, these songs are good. Ike is a genius. You have to separate the art from the artist. And these songs of Baby Get It On, fuck, man.
Side two, first comment, Ike was just waiting to explode.
He was. It almost feels like I just want to make my part here.
Just let me do one thing. I'm bursting.
Because this is so good. I wanna lend my chops to it. And he does. And they both sing this. They both sing this like they're so in love, even though Tina's already like out of love and is already contemplating leaving. Doesn't sound like it on this song. This song sounds like a happy couple. Of course it's not. It's a very dysfunctional and abusive relationship. But this song belies that completely. And it rocks for 5.5 minutes. And I tell you, you never get bored. It's like, baby, baby, baby.
It's a 3-chord rock song. It almost sounds like it has what I'd call a fast disco beat. Because it sounds
it's does. About the quarter it's actually notes. It was a disco hit.
The quarter notes on the kick drum there rather than...
You know what? I would wish, since you brought that up, I totally forgot about that. I wish that the actual rock disco songs like Miss You, which I really like though, but Do You Think I'm Sexy and songs like that were more like this, which is almost like they're rock songs like this, Baby Get It On, but it has some disco touches. Those other songs were more kind of disco-y disco.
Yeah, you can hear the disco more than you can feel the disco. Here you can feel the disco, but you don't hear it so much.
You don't hear it so much. And it's just brilliant. It's just a killer track. Oh, and then we get another killer track right after that. Oh, Bootsy Whitelaw, which I love. Just a good song. Just rocks so much, don't you think?
Yes. And this was over a blues kind of chord progression. This is the one I was mentioning, that cool echo synthesizer. Yeah. And that goes back and forth with the guitar soloing. So those two are kind of playing off each other. Wow.
Just a great song. Roll it on, roll it on, roll it on. Bootsy Whitelaw. It's just so catchy. It's just so unbelievably catchy. And Tina just sings like how she sings that. And it's just like, wow. Like, there's a way of singing it makes it, oh, that's good. But then there's a way of saying it that only a professional knows that makes you hit it out of the park. And she knows how to sing a certain song to hit it out of the park.
The first comment I wrote down when I was listening to, trying to figure out her vocals and analyzing them, there's a difference between vocal gymnastics and vocal dancing.
Oh, I hate vocal gymnastics. I hate vocal gymnastics. And sometimes with Ike and Tina, she did that.
But she's better at it. It doesn't bug me when she does it.
Oh yeah, because
it doesn't make me angry.
First of all, I don't think she has the chops because she's a very aggressive singer. I don't think she has the vocal capabilities to go high and low like those other people do, which I'm not going to name.
No, but she does play with her voice quite a bit in non-word like. Ways or takes the words and really bends and stretches.
But like Aretha, she knows how to do it.
Yes. Yeah.
And that's why you never accuse Aretha of doing vocal gymnastics, because it's almost like everything that Aretha does has a purpose. Kind of like with Tina. Pick Me Tonight is extremely inappropriate in any decade. It's definitely unbelievably inappropriate in 2023. But this was 70s, and even though it's inappropriate 70s. In the 70s,
what's the ABBA song?
It doesn't turn too many heads in the 70s.
Take a chance on me, that's what it does.
So it's basically about the only redeeming fact, even though it's actually a great song musically and everything, it's just the subject matter of this song is, it's about a guy who goes up to a girl who's 13 years old and says, "You're not ripe yet. You come and see me when you get to be of legal age," and then when she gets of legal age,
wow, how very noble.
she goes, "I'm gonna get you," and it's The only redeeming factor is that she's in charge. And she says, now I'm ripe. I see, I don't even like saying that. I really don't. She says, now I'm ripe and I'm making my choice. And so it's kind of in her control, but really it's a distasteful song. But it's still a good song as far as music is concerned. It rocks and it has a catchy chorus. But the lyrics are, especially since it's written by a guy, it's really...
That's a different time.
It was a different time. It really was. And you know what? I can kind of imagine 1975 in the mid-70s. And this, unfortunately, would not make you blink your eyes much at all.
No, you know what? This is a character song. It's a song with two characters and this is the story and that's it.
And you know what? The woman is in control.
Yes. Be offended if you want. I'm not gonna. Yeah.
And then Rockin' and Rollin', again, a rockin' song. I did like that one.
I liked Rockin' and Rollin'.
And you know what? There's something about just the words Rockin' and Rollin'. First of all, they sound like one word. And it always, or even when you say rock and roll, you know.
Yeah.
Downtown is a rock and roll. If there's something about it that just... rolls perfectly off the, no pun intended, but rolls perfectly off the tongue.
Rockin' and rollin',
and then when you put it with some rockin' music, just really works. It's almost unbeatable because just if you put rockin' and rollin' or rockin' like sweet little rockin' and rolla, it works the two words because they're so. Great together, like one word.
Yeah,
it's hard to fuck it up unless you write a really bad song.
There's certain words that work really well musically and lyrically, and some that don't.
Exactly. There's some words that when you put them together with other words will never for somehow
yeah, they're make you chunky and clunky and yeah. Don't even rhyme with orange.
But rock and roll or rockin' and rollin' or rock and roller, all, I don't remember, like Roxy Rolla. Like, even that, there's something about that.
Rah, 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 rah.
Yeah, yeah.
He's almost like an engine.
Yeah, it is. And
rah,
and the one thing that I took away from this song, other than it rocks like hell, like all the other songs on this side, is just how hard it is not to like it. Because it's just rocking and a roller. And just saying it, just without even knowing what the song is about. You could say, could you write a song about rocking and a rolling? I said, yeah, rocking and a rolling, me banana bopping.
Was it the Vanilla Fudge? Didn't they do a song that just had the words rock and roll?
Yes, on their last album. Yeah. Yeah, very last album before they broke up.
Yeah, I could do it.
Yeah, yeah. No, you know what? You could write, anybody could write a passable song with something like Rockin' and Rollin', but you have to write, yeah, that's not passable, it's not good enough. This is actually a good song, and it does rock and roll.
A thing I noticed about the Ike and Tina side was the first song and the last song, Baby Get It On, Rockin' and Rollin', those are both three chord songs.
They're very simple.
Flat 7, 4, 1.
Mm-hmm.
And they work really well. Bootsy Whitelaw is essentially just a blues song. It follows the blues progressions over and over again. Pick Me Tonight follows a verse chorus thing, but it doesn't deviate too much from that.
They're very similar.
And the thing I've noticed about this is that they're similar. They're like long vamps, long
because it sounds repeated kind chord of progressions. Doesn't it?
Where they do have the definite song written over it, but I'm thinking if you get to stage, that's where with these long songs with the repeated chords. You can choose to stretch them out very easily, and I kind of know.
I
suspect that's part of the Ike and Tina style there.
I think that's part of the Ike and Tina. I agree with you 100%. And you have to, even though this is near the end. I mean, this is right at the end. But you can imagine that when they record stuff like that, it's even better live because they extend it. And their band cooks because they're live.
They've got almost 20 years of experience doing this.
Yeah, and they're just one of the best live acts around. So you get that. Even a song like Baby Get It On, which sounds difficult because you got two voices going, and it's deceptive because it's not difficult, but it's because, like you say, it's the three chords, but it sounds difficult, and that is something in itself to make a song sound difficult when it's not.
Definitely, yeah. The playing had a bit to do with that because how these guys are playing.
Oh, they're playing like the. Oh, I can't.
You need some chops.
They're playing like they have chops, but they're also excited about the music, which they may not be, but they sound like it. And what I mean by they not be, it just may be another session to them. Who knows? They're session
players. It doesn't sound like just
But it session. Doesn't sound like it. It sounds like they're going to explode if they don't do these songs.
This sounds like everyone brought their A-game. They put their best into it.
Fuck, I love this album.
Wow.
I did not know how good this album. Even on first listen, I was going, this is a good album. This is better than I thought it was.
Yeah,
it's not that Las Vegas dribble I thought it was going to be.
I wasn't even expecting anything, but when Under My Thumb first came on, I'm like, is it my imagination? This is good.
Yeah, I you know what? I had the same thing. When I heard the very first song, Under My Thumb, I said, you know what? And there's a fantastic version by Streetheart, but a Canadian band, but for the length of time that this has to go on, because they're allowed to
both play of them,
for 7 minutes or whatever.
Really good bass playing on both.
And you could hear a lot of the Streetheart version in this. I don't know if they heard this version, but it sounds like they did, because
What year was the 70?
78 was when they did their version.
And
it just seems, because it has a lot, to me, I could hear a lot, because the bass is like, and the dynamics, which they use very well in the Streetheart version. And when I heard that, just like you said, when I heard that Under My Thumb, I said, okay, I knew right away, this is not what I thought it would be. This is well thought out.
Yeah, I kind of thought it might be, you know, in doing covers like this, it might be kind of tired and just doing it to fulfill a record company contract, but that is not the case.
No, and sir. I thought, oh, Acid Queen, oh fuck, it's gonna be a watered down version of the Who Tommy film version, because that was a different version. Oh fuck! Then I heard it. It's going, oh yeah, it's better.
Yeah, it's like they had time to work out to make it a little better. Yeah.
Yeah, I give this a strong 4 stars. I don't think I've read anybody give this record 4 stars, to be honest with you. Of all the, I haven't heard too many bad things said about this album, but mostly everybody has given it 3 stars. I find it
it's
hard to believe.
Better than that.
I find it hard to believe anybody listening to this album at least 3 or 4 times giving this 3 stars, because there's so much care and love, and
it surprises you when you first hear it, and by the third listen it's like, wow, this is the surprise is over. This is good.
And it gets better. You pick up on the strings more after the third listen, and the things that come in. And what's your
I think I've said most of the things I've had to say. I just one interesting thing I found with I was used to Tina Turner from the Private Dancer Beyond Thunderdome days. I was used to that as her vocal style. I'd heard a bit of Ike and Tina Turner, but on this one, when she's singing, she's when she gets up high, singing up high. That's when I kind of notice very close. That's where it sounds a little more like Aretha Franklin. And when she comes back down low, she sounds like Tina Turner.
Yeah,
if that makes any sense.
No, it does.
Other thing I found with this album, unlike some previous albums, this one sounds really good loud.
It does.
Yeah, you can turn this one up.
Which one were we?
The last one, George, I think,
Harrison.
Was, yeah.
George Harrison, Living in the Material World, actually does sound really good low. Some albums do that.
And maybe if you're in a really jaunty mood, you could turn that one up.
But this one is like, it full blast.
Yeah.
And this is a party album. Remember we were talking about, you never put George Harrison on at a party because it'll bring you down, because it's not that type of music.
Yeah.
This is like, what are you going to put on? Oh, you got to listen to this album, man. And that's the first one.
Yes, it'll be the opposite. It'll pick you up if you're down.
It'll get the chicks dancing in 1975 for sure.
No, I was absolutely surprised. This is a much better album than I imagined. And I can't imagine it being less than a 4.
Yeah, you know what? We are so insympatical on this.
On this
particular, it's kind of scary, because anything less than 4 to me,
if I just given it
a total injustice to the care that is brought to this record.
If I just given it one listen, maybe I could give less than that. But
oh yeah, I probably gave this 3 on a first listen. Just, you know, but I do that for a lot of albums. You know, first listens are becoming almost regular routine of. Sometimes just liking it. I've very rarely come across a record that I loved on first listen. So
yeah, I think there's been one or two that I liked on first listen. Then as they went by, I liked them less.
Yeah, and there are some, the other ones that go reverse.
Those are
there
rare.
Are, but I've rarely come across. I can't count the Roxy Music one because I've heard that 100 times. But there's rarely an album in the 70s that I come across. And it's not blaming the 70s, except the 60s with the Beatles always would grab you right away and the Stones. But the 70s had a lot of nuances that the 60s even didn't have. And very rarely, I find, do you go through the complicated world of the 1970s music scene. I think the golden age or the second golden age of rock and roll after the 50s. To me, the golden age as far as complexity and diversity and all these musics coming together, very rarely are you blown away by first listen because there's so much now that's going on in the music that's being played. But that just makes it more fun to listen to through the third time or the fourth time. And what a jewel. What a jewel in the rough. And I'm so happy. And Tina, thank you for directing me to this because...
And this one's not on Spotify. We had to go on...
Yes,
on the YouTube, you know, to find this one.
That was another reason.
What the heck?
This Tina's albums are not easy to get before Private Dancer, and they're not for streaming. Her first four albums. So I swear she told me to pick this album. I swear, Rob. And I thank you. Tina.
She has good taste.
This is good for you, Tina, because it totally encapsulates you, and it does give a good indication in the 70s of what you were like. Of course, Private Dancer is the album from the 80s on to listen to, but we can't play that. So thank you, Tina, for telling me not to play that other album, because I know Ike pissed you off big time. And thank you for directing me to this one. I've never done that before. I've never played an album and said, this is the wrong album.
This is wrong.
Yeah. I've sometimes said it before I picked the album. I picked an album and then changed my mind. But I've never played an album and then said it's wrong. And not because of the musical quality. It just felt wrong.
Yeah, I didn't know of her solo albums before Private Dancer. So.
Yeah, well, neither did I, except on... what I heard.
Yeah, what you'd read.
What I read. Paper. Yes, and, yes, you know. Exactly. Well, that's our... God, every show's long.
That's our show.
That's our show for today. Always long. Remember to tune in next week when we do our first show from our new home. And we have no idea how it will sound yet.
Been there, haven't seen it, but we're assured that it exists.
We know it
exists.
If
we're able to get there.
So just fingers crossed that it's going to be a good sounding. We will make it sound good, but we don't know how it's going to sound for the first show. So until then, as always, take care, everybody, and stay safe. My recommendation is to take your guitar at the end of this session today. Recommendation.